Session number 12012.
Bill Pickering, Reel 2. Was it an uneventful voyage?
Not exactly an uneventful voyage. We went on the Arundel Castle from Gourock in Glasgow, and we set sail. Took us about 3 weeks to get to Algiers. Apparently we went right out into the Atlantic and then back in again across the Bay of Biscay in order to escape U-boats. And we went through some violent storms, and the sailors told us that it was the worst storm they'd ever known. And the newspapers, which we read later on, said it had been the worst Atlantic storm in living memory. Certainly I would never have believed that waves could come so high. One of the ships that escorted the convoy with him was an aircraft carrier, and it actually was the ship almost next to us, but it used to disappear from view in the troughs of the waves. They were so high, and the rafts, which were lashed to the deck by very thick ropes, probably 2 inches or more thick, actually snapped, and all the foredeck of this Arundel Castle, where they'd built toilets because there were about 5,000 troops aboard, and they were all washed away. But on the other hand, it was so violent that they said there was no chance of any U-boats getting us. We actually saw one Condor German plane about the second day out. That was the only thing we saw until we got into the Mediterranean. We got into the Med, sailed past Gibraltar and could see the lights of the Spanish mainland, and then we were in calm water. And if that's the only first night of calm water we'd had, and the ship next to us, the Strathallan, was torpedoed. The rest of the night was spent listening to depth charges going off.
Who was with you on this voyage?
Well, the only people I can remember are about 40 or 50 belonging to SOE, cooks and general duty men, and probably about 30 of us signals, all radio operators.
What happened to you once you got to North Africa?
We got to North Africa and we got on the docks at Algiers, found that Arabs would buy anything that you wanted to sell, so we sold them our spare boots and spare vests, because soldiers did things like that. If they had anything spare and they could get money for it, they were so hard up, bearing in mind that wages even then, after being in the army for 2 years, I think my wages were about 21 shillings a week, or just over £1 a week. It might have been a little more. And by the time you'd sent half of that home, you didn't have much to spend, so that the prospect of making a bit of money by selling your spare vest or something was quite good, and we used to sell them. And then we marched from Algiers about 18 miles east to a place called Cap Matifou and set up a signal station there. This signal station was in touch with London. And we'd been there a few weeks when they sent us from there to the west of Algiers to a place called Club des Pins, the Pines Club, where we spent most of the early part of 1943 setting up a very big signal station codenamed Massingham, M-A-S-S-I-N-G-H-A-M, and I think we were known as ISSU-6, Inter-Service Signals Unit 6. That was the name, and it was a cover name for a very large radio station operating from Algiers to London and from Algiers to various agents in the field who would start to drop into places like Corsica and southern France. There were also a lot of FANI there, first aid nursing yeomanry, who were ladies who had volunteered, and they were nothing to do with nursing, but they were all trained radio or cipher operators.
Were there any problems in setting up this radio station, Massingham?
Not really. We had a Captain Corbett, Bill Corbett there, a Liverpudlian, and he was very, very good at organising things like this. I remember putting up all these very large masts, and we used to work stripped to the waist in the sun there in North Africa. Nice place to be. We used to go fishing off the shore by pinching plastic explosive, which was a new thing in those days. And we found that if we threw plastic explosive with a detonator into the water, it would explode and stun the fish, and we used to go out and swim and bring them in and have extra fish for our meals. King George VI came to visit us there, and I remember they set the beach on one side, a special section, so that you could go and bathe. And also, some of the first American paratroopers came there from Fort Benning in Georgia. They formed a unit. They were the first people of the American OSS, Office of Strategic Services, and they came to the SOE headquarters, and I think they were taught our methods of how we worked with agents in the fields, and they did a lot of the parachute training there. They started a parachute training school there. Used to run the planes, Dakotas, from Mason Blanche Airfield, and practice jumps and train their own operators and agents there, as well as train ours.
You were... How did you get onto operations yourself then?
Well, thereby hangs a story. I mentioned going to this Club de Paix, but prior to that I mentioned going up from Algiers to Cap Matifou. And after we'd been at Cap Matifou a couple of weeks, it was fairly obvious we weren't going to be sent to the front line. And this is what I joined the army for. I didn't go there, so I was a bit disgruntled at the time. And I got drunk one night and walked in the officer's mess and called the officers a few rude names. I was promptly taken by a guard and put in the nick. And they decided to transfer me out of the unit altogether. And after having sort of recovered and thought, well, I'll be losing all my pals and that, I wrote a letter to our commanding officer, who at the time was Lieutenant Colonel Dodds Parker, and apologised and said that I would prefer to stay with the unit and promise to behave myself, which I did from then on in. In fact, that's how I became promoted the very first time, because we went to Club de Paix, as I'd mentioned, and Captain Corbett was in charge. And he wanted to make up some NCOs into Lance Corporals. And he was very pally with another Liverpudlian who was a Corporal Smith. And this Corporal Smith, he was a son of a managing director of a big company in Liverpool, and knew Corbett pretty well. And apparently, I was pally with Smith, apparently Corbett had asked Smith, because Smith was in the orderly room and knew everybody, he said, who can we make into Lance Corporals? So Smith turned around and said, well, he said, how about Pickering? He says, Pickering, he says, isn't he the person who came into the officer's mess and called me an old bastard? He says, yes, that's him. He said, oh, good. He says, that's the sort of fellow we want. He says, if you'd call it me, he says, you'd call it these others here. And he promoted me into a Lance Corporal. And I was quickly promoted to corporal and then sergeant after that. But that's the reason he promoted me.
So you're telling me how you came to be on operations?
Yes. After that, I was sent to Tunis. And I was in Tunis for a few weeks, and I was recalled to Algiers. And they told me that I was going on operations, and I was going into Sicily to augment the first units of SOE to land in Sicily at Syracuse. So I went to Syracuse, didn't see any action there, set up a signal station because the other boys had then gone on to Palermo. I followed on to Palermo a couple of weeks later, and then the landing started in Italy. And the unit landed at Salerno in Italy with the 5th Army. Then it became known as Number 1 Special Force.
Did you land at Salerno?
I landed at Salerno, but 2 days after the others.
What was the landing at Salerno like?
Pretty drastic. There was a lot of artillery fire directed against us. And we were cowering around in places most of the time, hiding, getting in holes, until it died down, until the Germans started to retreat north of Naples.
Which ship did you go to, Salerno?
In an LST, landing ship tank.
And were you under fire as the LST was going in?
No. No, we weren't.
What happened to you next?
After Salerno, we went to Naples, and we set up headquarters in a district of Naples called Vomero, V-O-M-E-R-O, in the Villa Salve, S-A-L-V-E. And this is when I came to realise what sort of operations SOE were engaged in. I was with Max Salvadori, Malcolm Munther. He was the son of Axel Munther, the famous Swedish author who wrote The Story of Sam McKayley, world bestseller. Captain Gubbins, he was the son of Major General Gubbins, who was a commanding officer of our unit, of SOE. One or two other officers, Major McIntosh. He became the first man that entered Florence over the old bridge in a secret passage. And whilst at Naples, all these officers were engaged in contacting agents and smuggling them through the lines. We did a variety of jobs there. We ran a signal station to Algiers originally, and then SOE moved from Algiers to Monopoli in southeast Italy, just south of Bari, where they set up a big signal station there. We operated from Naples to Monopoli, carrying out all sorts of operations from Naples. We had a Lieutenant Simpson Jones that had a motor torpedo boat, which was used for landing agents up the coast of Italy. We did training. We trained in explosives. We had a little place in Ischia where they trained blowing up railway lines, blowing up bridges. And from there, or from Naples, we would take agents up the Adriatic coast, the Tyrrhenian coast, and drop them with rubber dinghies further up the coast. I went on a couple of trips.
Can you describe those trips in detail?
Not really. All I can say is that they were at night, and you'd get an agent, and he'd have all his kit, including his suitcase radio set, and we'd go up the coast with one of the naval men, and they'd drop an agent off in a rubber dinghy, and he'd just paddle off to shore, and we would leave. We didn't hang around. Now, that went on in the winter of late 1943, and Major Malcolm Munthey wanted to had a plan for getting somebody into Rome and operating a clandestine radio from Rome. And he put this plan to the Allied Force headquarters, who immediately told him, confidentially, that they'd already arranged to have a landing on the Anzio beachhead. Now, so Major Munthey then decided to form a party consisting of himself, Captain Mike Gubbins, Captain Salvadori, who was known as Captain Sylvester in those days, because they didn't want his name known to the Italians, another fellow with the same name as me, a Major Pickering, a driver called Mulvey from Liverpool, myself, an Italian by the name of Savili, and also another Italian by the name of Alberto Tarchiani. Alberto Tarchiani was later to become the Italian ambassador to the United States. I didn't know it at the time, but he had been a founder member of the Justice and Liberty Party. He'd been imprisoned by Mussolini, and he wanted to get through to Rome with us to set up this radio station. And the idea was that we landed in Anzio, got into Rome, and set up the station. In fact, when we landed at Anzio, the advance didn't go as we'd prophesied, and we were held up because the Germans surrounded us, and everybody took a terrific bashing. We tried once or twice to get through the lines and couldn't make it. Major Munthey, who was a bit of a madman, hit upon the idea of us getting an ambulance, getting some German uniforms and getting dressed up as German soldiers and driving through the line. In fact, he made preparations for this by arranging with the Americans who were in the line where we were. We were actually in the front line there, to give us a guard while we went out into no man's land and took uniforms off bodies. German jackets off bodies so that we could wear them. We actually went out and got the uniforms and buried the bodies. But before we could put the plan into operation, Munthey and Gubbins went to another part of the line where the guards division were. They took me along and we got caught in a lot of shell fire, and Gubbins was killed. Munthey was very badly wounded. They got him back to hospital. I went back to where I had my radio set. Before then, Salvadori had taken ill with jaundice, so that there were virtually no officers left, and we were told to evacuate the unit from Naples. It was no use going on any further, because the main officers had been killed, wounded and taken ill.
Did you see Munthey wounded?
We saw him wounded, yes.
How did it happen?
A shell landed in the trench where they were. And then, of course, there's all confusion. Stretcher bearers are running about all over the place. We lost Gubbins' body.
How did that come about?
Because it was a state, the line was in a state of flux. The guards were fighting, the Germans were fighting, it was backwards and forward. Shells were bursting all around. The only thing you could do was get out. No one could do anything, really. Gubbins was dead. And then the ground got ploughed up to such an extent that there was no chance afterwards of finding anybody.
Where was Munthey wounded?
In the head.
Did you go to his hell?
Pardon?
Did you go to his help?
Well, we just saw the stretcher bearers took him away. The stretcher bearers took him away. And he went into a field ambulance in Anzio, run by the Americans.
What kind of a man was he personally?
Very quiet, incredibly brave. A couple of, well, 2 or 3 days before, we'd actually set up our headquarters in front of our own lines. The Loyal Regiment were in the line, 1st Battalion Loyal Regiment were in the line at the time, and we were in front of them, and I can remember Gubbins and Munthe wandering about, both wearing kilts, one was a Cameron, one was a Gordon Highlander, both wearing kilts, wandering about looking for cooking utensils to start to make some food. And shells were popping all over the place. And I remember Munthe turning round to me and saying, "Joe, what are, look at all those fellas crawling over there." And this was the Loyals crawling about on the ground. And quite honestly, I wanted to get down and crawl myself and daren't. Sort of, he was setting the example, he wandered about, so I had to wander about, but I was frying to death. I wanted to get down. And anyway, nothing happened. I mean, they didn't get us or anything, but we found out that we'd set up our headquarters in a little bungalow or villa, whatever, and we were in front of the front line, and we got shelled to such an extent that we had to move out pretty fast. This was a couple of days before he got killed. Before Gubbins got killed, and with them we set up headquarters in a forward observation post used by the artillery. It was used by our artillery, it was used by the American artillery, and it was used by our naval ships too. They had an officer communicating with the ships offshore who were pounding the German positions, trying to keep them off us because, as I say, we were only a couple of divisions and we'd been surrounded by all these Germans. Who were panzer units, loads of tanks. They used to come up with these 88mm guns on what they call Tiger chassis and come and pound us and then go away again. But as I say, after these casualties to our three main officers, we decided to evacuate and came back to Naples. Then they sent me back to Monopoly. And I was a sergeant in charge of the signal station for under the main commander there was Captain Scott Job. And I remained there from about March to September. I was in the signal station March till August. Then they sent me on intensive training.
Excuse me. When you were in charge of the signal station, was it receiving signals, say, from the Balkans and so on,
yes,
from agents?
Yes, from agents, manned by Royal Signals radio operators and FANI.
What kind of responsibilities did you have then?
The main responsibilities were seeing that the rotors were right, that people were there to operate, that I used to have to do the duty rotor, and make sure that the timing of the schedules were all right, and make sure that we didn't get two skeds on at the same time. If you had two agents on the same time or the same wavelength, you were in trouble. And
did that happen?
It happened on one or two occasions. So much so that Captain Scott Job devised a great big wall chart in big capitals that made sure that you knew exactly who was on and when and what time they were coming on and who was operating to them. You used to get certain people, say on base, used to like operating to certain operators in the field. You get used to them, get used to the method of sending Morse and receiving Morse, because there is quite a wide variation in standards of receiving and sending Morse, and certain operators used to like operating to certain others. And as a person that ran the duty roster, you would try as far as possible to accommodate these people so that they did operate to the favourites. I got bored with that after a while. After Anzio and the experiences there, I said, oh, I'm not bothering going on operations again. But once you got back on base, I was the sort of person that wanted to do something a little more exciting. So I volunteered to get back on operations again.
When would this be?
This would be about August 1944.
So you were doing that work at the signal station for quite a few
months? Yes, quite a few months.
Was it easy to get accepted for action again?
Yes. I kept pestering Captain Scott Jobs saying, I want to go back on ops. And I was interviewed by a Major Temple at first to go on ops. I was interviewed, and there was a Corporal Farrimond interviewed, and he chose Corporal Farrimond to go on this op with him. Strangely enough, Temple was killed on this operation. His real name was Daruski. It was something, I don't know, as a son or a relative of a famous band leader in London. But he was killed. Neville Daruski, his name was. They called him Major Temple. He was killed on that operation. And then it turned out that Major Salvadori was going on an operation, and he chose me as his wireless operator. So I went in for more intensive training then, not particularly on radio operating, but on explosives and stamina. What did they call it? Silent killing. That was the term used. You know, ways and means of killing sentries, etc. Silently.
Did you like that?
Yes, I quite enjoy that. I'd always been a sort of person interested in sports and boxing and that sort of thing, so I quite enjoyed that. We also did a lot of small arms shooting, machine guns and that sort of thing. Explosive, blowing up railways and blowing up bridges. Then they'd send you out up into the mountains in Italy and dump you there for